Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 15th of April 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson. Myself, Brian Gerrish. Touch it and you're a terrorist.
Yes, indeed. So, legislation that was passed last week, the Counter-Terrorism and Border Security Act 2019, This creates a number of offences, but the one that I wanted to highlight on Friday's programme, but we ran out of time for that, was the offence of entering or remaining in a designated area overseas, Brian. And what this means is that the Home Secretary can designate an area anywhere that he likes in the world that is subject to parliamentary approval, apparently. But he will designate this area, and if you travel to that area, then you would be subject to potentially 10 years in prison. So this became law on Friday. And of course, the point that I thought was important was, you know, people with official journalism accreditation will travel to war zones and other places, Syria, for example. Yeah. But perhaps people that have been more effective at establishing the truth of what's been going on in some of these countries, but who do not have official journalism accreditation, may find themselves on the wrong end of this particular legislation. And that seems to me to be a pretty dangerous situation, bearing in mind that, for example, we would have known absolutely nothing about the reality of the White Helmets and their relationship to Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra Front and so on. We would have known nothing about the BBC being embedded with Al-Qaeda and so on, and when they were producing their Saving Syria's Children documentary, if it hadn't been for people like Vanessa Bailey, who, of course, as a British citizen, would fall under this legislation.
Yeah, and there's another twist here, Mike, of course, because overseas, many people regard British or Western-approved journalists as being government stooges, not trustworthy, so they're not going to let you into a country to report if you're actually covering in some cases, if you're carrying an official press pass from the UK.
Yeah.
So the UK government's now in a position where it can help start wars or unrest overseas. It can use the BBC to help stir that up with BBC Media Action. And then nobody else is going to report what's really going on, because if you dare go near it, you're going to be branded a terrorist. Mm. Pretty extraordinary stuff. And I hope our overseas viewers and listeners are picking up on this. Here's a bit of the detail. We've chosen The Independent, but it's been reported, of course, elsewhere. New law where clicking on terrorist propaganda once could mean 15 years in prison comes into force. This was a bit of it. It's the Counter-Terrorism and Border Security Act 2019. 2 days ago, this came into force. The new counter-terror laws likened to thought crime. So this is pretty interesting. Somebody at least is picking up on that. A raft of new measures coming in, including those designated areas that you've just been talking about, Mike. And this is the full provision. Offence of reckless expressions of support for a prescribed organisation. Government prescribes them. The government decides what's reckless. Create an offence of publication of images, an offence of obtaining or viewing terrorist material over the internet, an offence of entering or remaining in a designated area. On it goes. Extend extraterritorial jurisdiction for certain offences. It's also got to introduce further traffic regulations down the bottom, and of course provide for a statutory review of PREVENT, which is such a dangerous thing in the first place.
Yes.
So what's Javid had to say? Well, he said this: the Counter-Terrorism and Border Security Act 2019 gives police the powers they need to disrupt terrorist plots earlier and ensure those who seek to do us harm faced just punishment. Bit of an oxymoron there. As we saw in the deadly attacks in London and Manchester in 2017, the threat from terrorism continues to evolve, and so must our response, which is why these vital new measures have been introduced. And isn't it remarkable that all of this has really come to a head under the smokescreen of Brexit, while people's attention has been on Europe? We're actually gone a stage further in creating a dictatorship in UK, mm-hmm. press freedom being shut down. Now, this was one part of the report that I found interesting. I could be a little bit critical, but we'll take it at face value. Professor Joe Kanatatsi, who's a UN Special Rapporteur, Right to Privacy, it seems to be pushing a bit too much towards thought crime, the difference between forming the intention to do something and then actually carrying out the act is still fundamental to criminal law. So interesting that we've got a man who's actually quite well connected with the European Union, for example. He's UN, and we criticise quite often UN policies, but he's speaking out and saying this is akin to thought crime. Mm-hmm. And of course, it isn't a third world nation, so-called third world. This is the United Kingdom under Theresa May's Conservatives. So we'll just add a little bit more here. A report by the Joint Committee on Human Rights said the offence, punishable by up to 15 years in prison, is, quote, a breach of the right to receive information and risk criminalising legitimate research and curiosity. I find, because that's a common sense thing, isn't it? People are curious, they go looking at things. And we'll just bring in this one. Original proposals said people would have to access propaganda on three or more different occasions to commit a terror offence, but the benchmark was removed, meaning a single click is now illegal. But apparently we shouldn't worry, Mike, because the police are reassuring us that it's very unlikely there'll be a surge in arrests. I think that's absolutely right. What we will find is the number of arrests creeps in and increases very slowly. But nevertheless, they're going to rise because now the state, of course, can say who are the terrorists. And if you dare to go and question that, you are going to be labelled a terrorist yourself.
So I presume journalists are exempt from this. I don't see any indication of that.
I haven't seen academics to do with that at all, Mike.
Authors, people that are doing research for some kind of writing project. This is quite a draconian thing. And if you take this in perspective with what was done last week with the online harms white paper and the likely legislation that's going to come out of that, plus all the other stuff that, the arrest of Julian Assange is another example of it. We're going to come on to what's been going on in Australia in a minute with respect to the press and the trial of Cardinal George Pell. This is a massive shutdown of freedom of speech, a freedom of thought, more appropriately. And it
allows the key thing for me, Mike, is this allows the British government to cover its tracks. It starts the war, it ferments the unrest and the killing. It provides the arms and the ammunition and the munitions, and then it simply covers its tracks, because if you dare go looking for what's going on, you look at somebody else's opinion on what the British government is doing, you are going to be labelled the terrorist. Mm.
Okay, well, Sajid Javid this morning was giving a fantastic speech all about protecting young people's futures. This has been billed as his first big speech on crime. He said he was particularly concerned about knife crime. And he was justifying stop and search powers that the police increasingly have now. He's very concerned that the black and ethnic minority groups in the country may feel that they're being targeted in some way. But he says that's okay, because stop and search saves lives. So if you feel like you're being targeted, tough, because it saves lives and that's all that matters. Changing the lives of young people will not be an easy task. Crime is a way of drawing in those who feel worthless. He said serious violence should be treated like the outbreak of a virulent disease. The mindset of government needs to shift to combat it. Well, once again here, what we have, and this is quite similar mindset really to the online harms white paper, in the sense that they're trying to justify bringing in more powers for police in terms of stop and search and so on. A more draconian legislation and so on in a range of different areas, while at the same time not dealing with the underlying issues that cause people to carry knives in the streets and so on. And you know, he makes the point, he recognises the point in this speech that people's lack of belief in the future and the economic reality is part of the problem for this. But his solution is to bring in more stop and search and make you know, put the police against communities even more, rather than dealing with the economic problems that people are facing. So it's the same type of thinking that we sort of saw coming out of the white paper last week, and yeah, it's just completely wrong.
It's wrong. And a couple of interesting comments in our chat box, because somebody has said, well, actually, if you want to deal with knife crime, 17.4 million people were stabbed in the back over Brexit, which I think is a fair statement. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to say once again, all of this legislation crept in under a huge smokescreen of Brexit. So don't forget that. And somebody else pointing out that, of course, the government has been removing books from our libraries for quite some number of years. That's absolutely true. And the comment is this equates to the burning of books. The shutting down of the internet is the equivalent of burning books. And I would also agree with that statement.
Now, let's get on to Cardinal George Pell. Now, of course, he was prosecuted and found guilty of criminal offences with respect to child abuse in Australia in December. But the press, if you remember, was not allowed to report on it for quite some time. There were restrictions, suppression orders, as they were described in Australia. Well, if you breach a suppression order and you report on something that the court says you can't report on in Australia, you could be punished with a fine, well, 5 years in prison and a fine of $100,000 for individuals and $500,000 fine for companies. So prosecutors in Victoria have now accused 23 journalists and 13 news outlets of helping, of causing contempt of court by overseas media by breaching these suppression orders. So in other words, they're saying that these 23 journalists and 13 media outlets helped people, journalists in foreign countries, to breach the orders, where perhaps they thought that they were free from prosecution themselves. But, you know, there are many, many issues with the prosecution of George Pell. There is an appeal now because he claims that he was not didn't receive a fair trial. And this, is, of course, feeds into that. But what we have here is what's being described as a chilling effect on justice and democracy in Australia. And that was according to Matthew Collins, QC, who's a lawyer who represents the people that are being charged in this. But again, an attack on freedom of speech and on the media in particular. So, you know, where does this take us?
It takes us to a total dictatorship unless people stand up, Mike. And a lot of people ask us for good news. They say, we understand what's happening, but where's the good news? Well, I picked up on this morning. So this is the Twitter page for Julia Hartley Brewer, talk radio breakfast show presenter, 6:30 a.m. to 10 a.m. Monday to Friday, journalist, broadcaster. And what she tweeted out was this: how utterly ridiculous. And it was a retweet of the Met Police, who had tweeted that a man had been charged after a video was posted online that showed a cardboard model of Grenfell Tower being burnt. So she identifies this, I'm going to say quite rightly, as just utterly ridiculous. Let's have a look at the detail of this, because this was the actual Met Police tweet. And we've got a bit of detail here. A man has been charged following an investigation into a video posted online that showed a cardboard model of Grenfell Tower being burnt. Paul Bassetti, 46, of South Norwood, was charged on Friday with two counts of sending, causing to be sent grossly offensive material via a public communication network, contrary to Section 127, 1A and 3 of the Communications Act 2003. He's going to appear in Westminster Magistrates Court on Tuesday, the 30th of April. Five other men, aged 19, 49, 49, 55 and 19, were arrested under Section 4A of the Public Order Act, and they remain released but under investigation. Now, Julia Hartley Brewer says this is utterly ridiculous. I agree, because this is offensive stuff. But really, at the end of the day, what damage is it going to do? But the police have got capacity to arrest these men and they've got charges. I decided I would get in on her Twitter page. And so here's UK column replying. Julia, a great tweet which made us laugh. This was actually a, I've cut off the one I'm referring to. But you've also rightly picked up on the ridiculous Met arresting, charging men for a cardboard model of Grenfell on fire in crass bad taste. The state madness now includes dangerous censorship of free media details here. And I've put a link through to your excellent timeline on censorship, Mike. So my point here is we have now got journalists and people in the media picking up that something's wrong. They're starting to get uneasy. They're starting to comment on it. And if only more people would get onto these Twitter accounts and post replies and factual information, we would be making a big impact. I'm sad to say that there's too many people at the moment who for some reason seem scared or nervous to even put their names and faces on Twitter to start pushing out the truth. But the good news is people are waking up. If you want them to wake up quicker, get onto those pages and give them accurate factual information.
Now, yesterday, as we mentioned on Friday, there was a protest outside the prison that Julian Assange is being held in. And Patrick Henningsen was there. If you want to get a report that was recorded live at that from that event, then listen to the Sunday Wire last night at 21stcenturywire.com. But George Galloway was speaking. Chris Williamson, MP, was also there. Galloway said that you don't have to like him. You don't have to like everything he's ever written or published. But if you like the fact that we have the right to speak and know the uncomfortable truths our rulers don't want us to know, then you should be here in person or at least in spirit. If Julian Assange is criminalised and incarcerated for revealing the truth about what our rulers are doing, have done, then you might as well deliver yourself behind these walls. You might as well volunteer for a prison cell yourself, because you'll no longer be free and you'll never be free again. I think that's absolutely right. But, you know, Patrick reporting last night that the people that had been really holding a vigil outside the Ecuadorian embassy have now moved to the prison and are intending to stay there. So they need support. And I would encourage everybody to support them if you possibly can.
Because we can see how quickly this is closing in.
Absolutely.
It isn't just Assange after Assange. It's going to be anybody who's daring to challenge the British government.
Now, the other piece of news that was terrorism related today was the decision to give legal aid to Shemama Begum, who's the ISIS bride. So she's been given legal aid to fight the decision to strip her of UK citizenship. Organisations like Liberty are saying that this is a necessary thing because their point is that to remove somebody's citizenship is the biggest sanction that you can take against anyone. I'm afraid, although I have difficulty with this one, I think because there's so many people that are deserving and are being banned or being having legal aid denied to them at the moment. I think this is an important one because at the end of the day, there are questions to be asked about this woman and people like her, because she left the country under the age of 18, apparently without a passport. And you've got to ask the question how that happened.
How was that possible?
How was that possible?
Yeah.
So my feeling is that as much as I don't like what she did and can do nothing other than condemn it, I think she was a pawn in a game here, and we need to get a bit more of the detail of what that game was.
Yeah, and innocent until you're actually judged guilty in a proper court of law.
Well, right? Exactly.
And the moment, of course, this is removed for one person, it's removed for everybody, ultimately.
Okay, quick reminder that there is a crowdfunder going on for Robert Stewart to produce a documentary on saving serious children. This is the BBC documentary that I mentioned earlier in the programme. where apparently the BBC created a fake report on a fake event in Syria. Robert Stewart has done some pretty meticulous forensic investigation of that, and we've covered that on this on the UK column, and would encourage everybody that can possibly do so to give some money towards this. They're looking to raise £70,000 for this project. It is vitally important that this documentary gets made.
And of course, a good documentary on this one, Mike, is The Thin End of the Wedge, to exposing what the BBC has been up to in a wider sense. Mm. So BBC exposed on this one relation to Syria, all the other things start to follow.
Yes, indeed. Right, now, where are we? China. The Chinese Navy has pushed out this video today, all about the 70th anniversary of the Chinese People's Liberation Army Navy. So this is apparently a glimpse of the submarine force. This is the Navy's first branch and also one of its three main focal points of interest and development and so on. So they're pushing out this video clip all about their Navy at the moment. And it appears to be functioning reasonably well, at least, contrary to the UK, Brian, because here we are, less than the full complement. Seven Royal Navy sailors have been sacked and thrown off HMS Talent. This is a hunter-killer nuclear submarine. And they were apparently caught taking cocaine during a party while they were docked in Devonport in Plymouth here. And so they've been removed from their jobs. HMS Talent they'd intended to send it out on Friday to go and hunt down all those nasty Russians that are flying, sailing around the Atlantic Ocean, Brian. But they haven't been able to, because they don't now have a full complement of crew, and they have to try and get staff from somewhere else. It's not clear where they're going to get it from yet. But the Ministry of Defence had this to say: a zero tolerance drugs policy, and will not tolerate misuse of drugs by any service personnel in any form or at any time. Any personnel caught taking drugs will be discharged. Now, that is true, but the question is, do they have a zero tolerance drugs policy? Has it been communicated to their staff? Because, apparently this is not a new problem. This is from 2017. The Independent: Royal Navy dismisses nuclear submarine sailors for absolutely disgraceful cocaine and prostitute parties.
Yeah.
So there seems to be a cultural problem within the...
Well, Mike, this is a major breakdown in discipline. Over the years, there's been occasional drugs problems. Wherever it's increased in civilian society, the military have had problems. But if you get this happening on board a nuclear submarine, you've got huge problems, because these crews are very professional. They live in an immensely dangerous environment. They know full well they make a mistake. It's not just their colleagues that die, they're likely to die as well. So this is a massive breakdown. And a lot of reports that we've been getting from recently retired military personnel all saying the same thing. There is a massive breakdown in discipline. They're talking about bullying, alcohol, drugs, and the fact that, of course, everybody's under immense pressure because there's this huge shortage with regard to manning. And that's, of course, because the government's recruitment policy run by Capita has been a massive failure, but nobody's going to talk about that. So I think this one is particularly dangerous. On a ship, somebody who's on drugs might be able to get away with their day's work and nobody gets hurt, but you make a mistake on board a submarine and there's going to be a fire, or you're going to sink, or something unpleasant is going to happen. So this is immensely dangerous.
Yeah, and I mean, just to make sure everybody understands, that the cocaine was not taken on board, it was taken at a party. But if, for example, in the civilian nuclear industry, employees in the civilian nuclear industry are subject to drugs tests, randomized drugs tests. Yeah. They must have appreciated that.
Of course they did, but it shows that morale is at rock bottom, because right, if they had any pride in their professional job, in the service, in what they were doing, they wouldn't be doing this. Mm. This, to me, this would be sailors who have basically had enough. They don't care. So the moment they're off the submarine, they're ashore, they're drinking, they're taking drugs, they're wiping it out of their lives. This is morale at rock bottom. Mm. And we just bring this one in. Now, we're using a Russia Today report, and maybe somebody's going to snipe at us for doing that, but Russia Today picked this up. It needs picking up, because this is the head of the British Army doing an absolutely bizarre video clip where he's chastising the army for other crimes taking place. Now, there's been some very unpleasant bullying. There's been rapes that have taken place. And of course, there was a lot of upset over the soldiers using Corbyn's head as for target practice on a range. But how does the head of the army respond? He makes this utterly bizarre video. And some of the responses are really quite funny, because people have come in pretty quickly. We've got one here. Looks like there's been a coup and the army has seized Broadcasting House. So that was somebody on social media. These are pretty self-explanatory. An important statement to make, but the production values are pretty laughable. Sounds like my old headmaster, which is absolutely true. And we'll just do one more. This is, what is this? This is a red... I've forgot what it is now, but anyway, it's a general comedy program on
Red Dwarf.
Red Dwarf, thank you, from the TV.
Yeah.
And why were people coming out with these comments? Well, just it's the mannerisms. We'll see if this will just play to give you an idea. But it was just like a headmaster chastising his boys. But it's the whole hands on hips.
Yeah,
what is
demeanor,
this?
Yeah.
I'm trying to look tough, but I can't really handle it. And the studio is just laughable. I mean, this is the state the military has got to as a result of government policy, which of course has changed the way the military work, changed the behaviour, the work effort, ethic and professionalism. So I think these problems have been created, but they're getting worse.
Mm. Now, one of the issues with relating to European Union Defence Union has been not just about the unification of military forces, but the unification of the industry as well. And we continue to see this consolidation and unification. Now, this is Rheinmetall Defence and BAE Systems, Global Combat Systems Limited. And this has turned into a Competition and Market Authority investigation. So they're saying that the investigation was opened on the 12th of April, the launch of its merger inquiry by a notice to the parties. And then on the 15th of April, it's today, the Competition and Markets Authority is considering whether it is or may be the case that this transaction, if carried into effect, will result in the creation of a relevant merger situation under the merger provisions of the Enterprise Act 2002. And whether that's expected to result in a substantial lessening of competition within any market or markets in the United Kingdom for goods and services. So, BAE Combat, Global Combat Systems was formed in 2009. This was itself a merger of BAE Systems Land Systems, Land Systems Munitions and Ordnance, and BAE Systems AB in Sweden. And it's also a 50-50 joint venture with Nexter, CTA International, which is located in Bourges in France. And then Rheinmetall, of course, is the European defence contractor. It has a presence in two corporate sectors, defence being one of them, six divisions and headquartered in Düsseldorf in Germany. So we're just seeing this continuing integration and unification, not only on the defence side itself, but on the industry side. And right. It's clear that it's part of the same policy agenda.
Brexit stalled. So Brexit kicked into the long grass and behind the scenes, the EU defence unification, including all of the EU's, the UK's military and defence industries and procurement system, that's all accelerating. Mm. Nobody talking about it now. BBC's gone totally silent on Brexit, I think.
Well, not quite, because here's the, not at least Bill Cash hasn't gone silent. Here's the Telegraph. And he's reporting this, or he's put this article in the Telegraph today. Theresa May's Article 50 extension is illegal and will be challenged in the courts. Now, we reported that he had made these comments, similar comments in the House of Commons last week. But he's now written this in the Telegraph and saying that After hours of discussions with QCs and former judges, I believe the British government extension of Article 50 is unlawful. He says, it is a fundamental principle of UK constitutional law that government may not use its powers to frustrate the international the intention of Parliament, and that includes with respect to international agreements. Parliament's intention is to be found and only to be found in the laws that it makes, in other words, legislation. And he's saying the Withdrawal Act expressly states the European Communities Act 1972 is repealed on exit day. Parliament originally set that day precisely at March 29th, 2019, but the government has purported to extend this by statutory instruments. These can be challenged in the courts. And he goes on to talk about Gina Miller and the fact that she brought the case to the courts, which created or caused the Withdrawal Act 2018 to exist in the first place. And he's making the point that within the Withdrawal Act 2018, that it's quite, or that the court decision on that Withdrawal Act is quite specific in saying that the Withdrawal Act could not be changed with the use of a statutory instrument. It had to be changed through primary legislation, and that primary legislation has not been created and passed by Parliament. It has only passed a statutory instrument. So that's what he's saying. In parallel with that, at the start of April, on the 2nd, the English Democrats, which is a political party, a nationalist political party, launched a judicial review, which is claiming that the Prime Minister cannot lawfully agree to an extension to the period before the United Kingdom could leave the European Union under Article 50. And the court is going to be asked, or is being asked, to declare that because she had no such power, that the UK actually automatically left on the 29th of March. Yep. So I suggest that people read Bill Cash's article from The Telegraph. It is a very important point that he's making. He is he understands the Constitution very well, and he is qualified to speak on this. His point is absolutely valid.
Yeah.
Now, finance derivatives. Derivatives are still too dangerous, according to Bloomberg. So they posted this. It's an editorial that they posted earlier, or a couple of weeks ago, warning that the international derivatives clearing houses, which have been set up by the major banks, they're handling most of the credit derivatives contracts. But, you know, they're making some useful points in this article. They're highlighting the fact that derivatives contracts are bets on something else that's going on in the financial markets. The article says the evidence isn't encouraging. Once collateral is depleted, there's not much cushion. Guarantee funds prepaid by all customers typically amount to less than 10% of the total collateral. Late last year, in a single default in the Nordic power market, burned through two-thirds of a NASDAQ clearinghouse's guarantee fund. If the clearinghouse's owners, which is London and Wall Street banks, have so little skin in the game, competing for business will tend to make precedence over ensuring that customers post adequate collateral. So really what this article is doing is highlighting the danger to the financial system as a whole of derivatives contracts and the scale of the derivatives contracts. So I do recommend people read that because it gives some good definitions. But of course, it's not, that is absolutely vital aspect of this. But in terms of individual businesses and individual people's lives, of course, the derivatives contracts have had a massive impact, and this continues to get some coverage. So this is a website called Interest Rate Swap Loans. Now, this is something that is continuing fallout from the 2007-2008 financial crash, where small businesses, small and medium-sized businesses, were offered loans by banks, but they were only offered these loans if these small businesses took out an interest rate swap, which is a form of derivatives contract. It was being sold to them as a sort of special type of insurance to deal with potential moves in interest rates. But, of course, most people who have no financial background didn't quite understand the implications of taking these loans, and it was the only way to get the finance that they needed at the time. And as a result, many businesses have gone out of business. They've had their assets stripped. Now, the main banks involved in this, or at least alleged to be involved in this, are HSBC, Barclays, RBS, Yorkshire and Clydesdale banks. And Yorkshire and Clydesdale are owned by National Australia Bank. But this fight continues with people trying to get some kind of reparations for this. But in the meantime, Noel Edmonds back in the media. This is Bristol Live. And he is saying that he has now evidence of a police cover-up with respect to this type of operation, with respect to Lloyds Bank. And he's saying that several small business owners, including himself, say they've been ruined by the bank's business support unit in Bristol. But Lloyds has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing. And even in Somerset Constabulary, the police have said that, they have decided that no crime was committed. So this then led to the Thames Valley Police and Crime Commissioner, Anthony Stansfield, getting involved to try to assist investigations. But they, even in Somerset, police have so far refused to accept that that assistance, and they say that they have found no evidence of crimes at Lloyds in Bristol. So Noel Edmonds, again, trying to highlight that. In the image that you can see on screen there, he is showing two documents with Avon and Somerset police logos on. He has not yet made these documents public, as far as I know, but he is threatening to do so unless something is done about this. There's some movement on this. But it's a hugely interesting part of this case, because it's while the payment protection insurance that many people took out with respect to personal loans has had a response from government to force the banks to offer compensation for the problems with that. Small businesses have had no such support from government, it seems. And I wonder whether the implications for the banks are even bigger than they were for personal protection insurance.
Yeah. And what are we talking about? White collar crime. We're talking about fraud and corruption. And we've got problems with the police dealing with it. But let's come in at the good angle. And it was last year, back in June 2018, that we had the opportunity to meet the Police and Crime Commissioner for Thames Valley Police, Anthony Stansfield. Now, he was in the press at the time saying this. I find it quite extraordinary that the chairman of the Financial Conduct Authority was the senior partner of KPMG that did the audits of HBOS Bank. They overlooked £1 million fraud and a multi-billion pound hole, probably approaching 40 billion in the accounts. And yet the man went on to become chairman of the FCA. So he was pretty unhappy at what he was seeing. And he was very, very confident that what he was seeing was crime underway. There was a little bit more here. People with small debts were bankrupted, then had their assets stolen off them. But they're worth many times their original debt. And that is divided up between the cronies, in my view, the insolvency practitioners and others. And vast sums of money simply disappears. Where did all the money go from the HBOS case? I think probably at least 600 or 700 million went straight abroad. I think we've only recovered 15 million out of a vastly bigger sum. Who made the money and where is it sitting? So this is a police and crime commissioner who was absolutely at the heart of his game. He was calling the shots and he was demanding that the right action was taken. And Thames Valley Police was in behind him here. They were doing the job. Now, we'll just come on to this one because he's pushed a letter out over the last couple of days. And we'll bring that up on screen, hopefully. Now, this is going out as a sort of public announcement around Robin. The Lloyds Bank Bristol Recovery's Business Support Unit victims have contacted me regarding what they believe is fraud. If you've been affected by Lloyds Bank in any part of the country and then been transferred to the Recovery's BSU and then had your assets sold by an appointed LPA of Lloyds Bank, could you please forward a brief account to Mike McGrath, who is collecting information to send to the police regarding the claimed fraud. A list of over 50 names have already been put together by Mike. If you believe you've been affected by any of the Lloyds Bank Bristol actions, could you please forward your details to, and there's the email address, who will then forward to the police to help with their investigations into this matter. So this is a police and crime commissioner really getting stuck in. But Mike, you've already said that we've got a problem because it seems that Avon and Somerset Police are shy of picking up and assisting. There's accusations being made in Bristol against Lloyds Bank. We understand that, well, we've said it as this, that we understand that in contrast to Thames Valley police investigations against Lloyds Bank, Avon and Somerset police have failed to collaborate with Thames Valley regarding Lloyds banking fraud allegations in Bristol, which are assessed to be greater than the 1 billion Lloyds Reading fraud. Mm. So Thames Valley police trying to do their job, trying to team up with Avon and Somerset police. This is good police work, isn't it, Mike, to team up when you think you're on the trail of something like this. But for some strange reason, Avon and Somerset police do not want to collaborate with Thames Valley police looking at the crime. Now, I've put on screen Chief Constable Andy Marsh from Avon and Somerset Police. It was only a couple of years ago that he was being investigated. This was over a case where a young girl had been abused in a special needs school. Now, he was found completely not guilty of anything. He was totally exonerated. But it is fascinating when we get into the report that was carried out by Essex Police. They said this, Chief Constable Marsh has now been under investigation for 4 years. Whilst he's been held to account, he has conducted himself with great professionalism and dignity. However, it's clear to see the personal distress and impact this matter is now having on him in both personal and professional capacity. So he was fully cleared there. And if you read the report, it's telling you very clearly that in a lot of cases he wasn't in post when decisions were made. But what you do start to learn is a little bit about how the police do something. So this is Avon and Somerset's police and crime commissioner. She says on the website, this latest investigation against Chief Constable Andy Marsh has taken 7 months. Essex Police has spent hundreds of hours on this matter and reviewed thousands of documents, and I'd like to thank them for their time. Well, what did they produce? They produced a 22-page report, and something that came to the surface in it was the fact that the police were being accused of managing their reputation. And here in paragraph 13, it says this, the only reference to reputation within any document provided is at point six of the terms of reference for the multi-agency group dated the 16th of April 2013. At point six of that document, it states, quote, to manage the reputation of all agencies involved and to maintain or enhance public confidence. Now, this was the public challenging the police on an investigation into the brutal rape and sexual assault of a very, very vulnerable girl in a vulnerable girl's school. And they're saying, well, no, we weren't managing the reputation. But they were already locked into a multi-agency group that was managing the reputation. So would it be fair to say, is Avon and Somerset Police now managing reputation
on behalf
in
of
this
Lloyds?
Case? Yeah. And it's what we don't know that causes the problem. And the other point that we're going to stress here is that, of course, we now have the police losing their separation of powers because they're locked into these multi-agency teams, MAPA, the multi-agency public protection arrangements, which keep records on the public in a secretive way. So the public doesn't know really who sits on the board, doesn't know what information has been kept, while those teams are managing their own reputations. Mm. So I find something rather extraordinary here. You would have thought that the Chief Constable, after getting a very hard time, maybe not his fault, over the failure of the police to investigate a crime properly in Hampshire, would be hot on the button to support Thames Valley Police to investigate what appears to be massive, or allegations of massive banking crime. Mm. But strangely, no. Well, there we go. Should we be worried? Well, I think we should, because this is the state of GCHQ. We've just heard a little bit about Britain's military, but the Telegraph, GCHQ codebreakers crack the cryptic code of Frank Sidebottom. So there
we are. The most important thing you could possibly be doing.
Absolutely. They can't manage to crack communications between people abusing children, even if they're close to Britain's royal family. But GCHQ, which of course is the beacon of professionalism in spying and communications intelligence throughout the world, we are pleased to announce that GCHQ can crack the Frank Sidebottom code. And I have to say, of course, they didn't, because they were only able to do it because one of Frank's families gave them a pretty good clue. And then they said, we've got it. Mm. So should we be worried?
Yes.
Yes. We'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us. We will be back at the same time on Wednesday. I'm sorry, I have trouble with the days of the week. And if you're not already a subscriber of UK Column, please consider taking out a subscription and or making a donation. We can only do what we do with your financial support. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.